are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for Food and Stuff, read by Gretchen Miller, featuring Smitten Kitchen. We're going to start off today with a recipe for fennel, prosciutto, and pomegranate salad. I cannot resist buying pomegranates. When they start popping up in stores each year, I have to take them home with me and either beg Alex to take them apart in his neat or organized way, show off, or do it myself and splatter the walls in my shirt and stain my fingertips a telltale pink for days. Typical. It's all worth it. They are this seafood phobic's caviar. But aside from, well, you know, eating them straight, which is nothing to complain about, I rarely know what to do with them. What does one make with pomegranates? Oh, I'm sure all of you creative people have 100 ideas. You make pomegranate upside-down cakes and delicate custards with whole seeds suspended in them. You freeze them into bubbly sorbets. But me, I just have this salad. Oh, and I didn't even eat it. Yep, that's right. I'm telling you about a recipe, in fact, encouraging you to make it, that I haven't even tasted. I have some nerve. But really, I was stuffed. We had too much food at the election night party, and I put this out late, and when eating a bite of it would have sent me over the edge, or worse, rendered me too full to eat dessert. Yet everyone loved it, picked at it, and eventually left none on the plate for me to eat the next day when I was all, who ate all my food? So you should make this. It's really, really good, I hear. Fennel, prosciutto, and pomegranate salad. Adapted from Bon Appetit, November of 2008. This serves 4 to 6. You'll need 2 cups of very thinly sliced fennel bulb, 3 tablespoons of extra virgin olive oil, divided, 1/4 teaspoon of coarse kosher salt, 6 cups of arugula, about 4 ounces, 1 cup of thinly sliced green onions, 1/4 cup of thinly sliced mint leaves, 1.5 tablespoons of balsamic vinegar, 6 ounces of thinly sliced prosciutto, torn into strips, 1/2 cup pomegranate seeds. You're going to toss the fennel and 1 tablespoon of olive oil in a medium bowl, and then sprinkle with 1/4 teaspoon of salt. If you're planning ahead, I did this a day in advance. Then you're going to combine the arugula, green onions, mint, vinegar, and 2 tablespoons of olive oil in a large bowl and toss, and then season with salt and pepper. Divide greens among plates and then top with fennel and drape with prosciutto and sprinkle pomegranate seeds over. Enjoy! Next recipe we have is for spanakopita, one of my favorites. I finally conquered my fear of making spanakopita, the Greek savory spinach and feta pie. And yes, this means I'm going to tell you about it. It took me so long because, however pathetically, I find phyllo, the thin dough used to produce the flaky layers in many Middle Eastern and Balkan pastries, stressful. The tissue-like sheets can dry into crumbles in what feels like seconds. Having to brush each layer with butter or oil before using it is challenging in a small kitchen and a lot of work in any size. Over the years, I've auditioned many spanakopita-ish pies that allowed me to hedge a bit on the phyllo. Triangles, that's only 1 sheet at a time, made it less scary. Spirals, ditto with 1 sheet. This recipe is in Smitten Kitchen every day. Galettes, using a pie-like dough. And even skillets, where I just messily crumbled some phyllo on top. All were good, none were this. This is exact spanakopita I crave, more doable than I thought possible. So what changed? Well, TikTok, my favorite diversion. I spent the last few weeks working on the copy edits for my next cookbook coming out this fall. And it obviously means that I would scroll TikTok to rest my brain a little between detangling gram and grammar inconsistencies. A spanakopita video from like Eat Like Greek with Julie, which is on TikTok, Instagram, and YouTube, appeared, and it's all I've thought about since. I watched probably 24 times over the next 2 weeks. The moment my edits were in, I went straight to the kitchen to make it. It did not disappoint, not even a tiny bit. So 5 things were different about this spanakopita than any that I have made before. The sheets are not brushed individually, painstakingly with oil. You just drizzle it generously over every sheet or two right in the pan. Next, there's no stovetop step. The onion goes in raw, yet is not crunchy or sharp in the pie. If you've ever cooked with fresh spinach, you know there's a lot of water in it, and most recipes begin with wilt, then ring step. This did not. I fully expected it to slice into a puddle of pie, and this just didn't happen. It wasn't even soggy. Do not ask me to explain the science of it. Just enjoy the freedom from this step. So you can watch some TikToks with the time that you save. Next point, we mix this with our hands and it's better off for it. I'm sorry for the word choice, but squishing everything together gets the feta evenly over every leaf of spinach while softening everything. You start with an unwieldy mountain of spinach and end up with a tightened mixture ready to bake. Just do it. Next point, the recipe uses a mix of flat and scrunched phyllo sheets for the most texture, including a layer in the middle of the spinach. Scrunching is fun. The pastry looks like rumpled bed sheets beckoning a nap, which is the energy that speaks to me on this icy January week when this was written. We cut the pie into squares before we bake it. I've seen this technique for baklava, but never spanakopita. But it's brilliant here for the same reasons. You won't shatter the pastry as you serve it. Plus, the top ends up much more dramatic and crunchy. The center seems to cook more evenly, and it allows for more evaporation, thus less potential sogging. The result is the best spanakopita I've ever eaten and certainly made. I hope you feel equally triumphant when you pull it off at home. Here's the recipe. Spanakopita serves 12 to 16, but you will have no trouble eating 2. Time, 30 to 45 minutes. Prep, 45 to 60 to bake. And the source, it's adapted from Eat Like Greek with Julie. You'll need 1 1/4 pounds of baby spinach, roughly chopped, 1 cup of red onion from 1 small or 1/2 large, finely chopped, 6 to 8 scallions, about 2.25 ounces or 65 grams of scallions, thinly sliced, 2 cloves of garlic minced, 1/3 cup of chopped fresh dill or more to taste, 1/3 cup of chopped fresh mint or more to taste, 1/2 cup of chopped fresh parsley, 3/4 pound, that's 12 ounces or 340 grams of feta drained and crumbled, 1 large egg, kosher salt and freshly ground black pepper, 1 pound of package of phyllo or phyllo pastry defrosted, and olive oil. You're going to heat your oven to 375 degrees Fahrenheit. In your largest bowl, place the spinach, onions, scallions, garlic, herbs, and feta. Use your freshly washed, of course, hands to mix everything together, truly squeezing the feta into the other ingredients and breaking up the spinach a bit more as you do. I promise it's fun. When the ingredients are tightly mixed, taste a pinch and add salt and pepper as needed to season it well. I use 1.5 teaspoons of kosher salt and many grinds of black pepper. Add egg and mix until it disappears into the spinach. Unwrap and unroll your phyllo so it's on a flat pile and ready to use. I do not keep it covered with a cloth because we will use it fast. Coat in a 12-inch cast iron skillet or equivalent pan, like a 12-inch cake pan or 9x13-inch baking dish, generously with olive oil. You're going to want to be generous with the olive oil throughout this dish for the best flavor and texture. I estimate that I use 1/2 cup total in this dish, but probably more. You're going to arrange 4 to 6 sheets of phyllo around the pan, draping each across the bottom and letting the extra hang off over the side of the pan and drizzle with olive oil. Rumple 2 to 3 sheets of phyllo one at a time so they just cover the bottom of the pan, and drizzle with olive oil. Arrange half of the spinach mixture across the bottom, and then scrunch 4 to 6 sheets of phyllo, think hamburger shaped, and arrange over spinach and drizzle with olive oil. Spoon the remaining spinach mixture evenly over those scrunched sheets. Fold the parts of the phyllo sheets draped over the sides of the pan over the spinach filling one at a time. Drizzle this closed top with more olive oil. One at a time, rumple the remaining sheets so they fit over the top of the pan, and then every layer or two, drizzle with more olive oil and finish with a final drizzle of olive oil. Use a sharp, serrated knife and cut the spanakopita into serving-size squares. Bake in preheated oven for 45 to 60 minutes until the top is very crispy and nicely browned. Let cool on a rack for 15 minutes before serving, and you'll need to cut it again, most likely, but it won't mess up the pastry very much. Leftovers keep for 1 week in the fridge and could also be frozen. To reheat from the fridge, you're going to place uncovered in a 350-degree oven until warmed through and the pastry is crisp again. That'll take about 15 to 20 minutes. Here's some notes for the recipe. For the spinach, you can use fresh or frozen spinach for this. If you're using frozen spinach, you'll need roughly 1.5 10-ounce packages. Each package is equivalent to 1 pound of fresh. So you want to defrost it and squeeze out any extra liquid when you do. The phyllo, short of making your own from scratch, truly not as scary as it sounds, but that post for another day. You will want to buy it prepared. It usually comes frozen, and most packages will tell you to defrost it in the fridge for a day before using. And phyllo pastry comes in many thicknesses. Julie recommended number 7, which is thicker than what I would get, number 4. All of these will work, but there might be fewer sheets of a thicker one in a 1 pound package, and this is totally and completely fine. But when there is a range in the recipe, for instance, crumble 4 to 6 sheets, you will use the lower number for a thicker phyllo. So I am using this, and I am so glad that I have a mega-sized bowl when needed. There is a link at smittenkitchen.com. And I'm currently obsessed with these serrated paring knives, and yet again, another link on the website. Next, we have a recipe for easy Basque cheesecake. While I do not think that the internet necessarily needs another recipe for burnt Basque cheesecake, it turns out I did. And since you're stuck with me for as long as you're here, pull up a chair, because we cannot get enough of this one. What is burnt Basque cheesecake? It's also called San Sebastian cheesecake. It's been around since the late 80s when it was created by a cook named Santiago Rivera at his restaurant and pincho bar, La Viña, in San Sebastian, Spain. There are a whole bunch of things that set it apart from American-style cheesecakes. The biggest is that there's no graham crust. In an interview, Rivera explained that when you bite into it, the cookie prevents the cream cheese part from dissolving. He wanted it to be more like chocolate mousse so that the flavor goes straight from your fork to your palate to your brain instantaneously. So not only does the cheesecake have no crust, it's also served closer to room temperature so it tastes less dense. It's slightly flan-like due to the addition of heavy cream, and it's baked at a higher temperature so it gets scorched and caramelized on top that contrasts gorgeously with a creamy interior. Oh, and this is the most blessed thing. No water bath. Cracks? Sinking centers? Here's the rusticity. Here the rusticity is intentional. So, what did I need from Basque cheesecake that wasn't already out there? Well, first, I wanted less. I'm the only one who finds cheesecake to always be too much. A giant, heavy, round, springform pan of 2 pounds of cream cheese, half a dozen eggs, an hour of baking time. It's such a commitment. The loaf? Petite, easily sliced, a neat rectangle that fits easily in the bottom of a Sephora shopping bag, 45 minutes baking time. Next, I wanted it quicker, a 5-minute batter, the kind I use for cheesecake bars with all the berries. And I don't mean 5 minutes once the cream cheese is at room temperature or 5 minutes once you've measured a bunch of things. I mean 5 minutes total. Once I realized a food processor or a high-speed blender turns cold cream cheese into batter in about 30 seconds, I haven't bought cream cheese to room temperature since. Finally, while most Basque cheesecake recipes I've seen use some flour, I saw no reason this couldn't be gluten-free and used cornstarch instead. Plus, cornstarch makes for the silkiest, most unforgettable texture. Believe me, I was tempted to add a cherry syrup or a sherry-infused whipped cream finish, but we've found we like this cheesecake's best adornment and frippery-free exactly like this, which means that also you can make it twice as often, so we can't stop. Next recipe, homemade Pop-Tarts. I've never had a Pop-Tart until college. I realized that for some people, this may cause a shocked reaction on par with my husband's, the time I told him I've never watched Goonies before. Obviously, I grew up under a rock, right? Well, thus given my proximity to concrete-like materials, you'd think I've been better prepared for the texture of the one that I purchased from the vending machine in the basement of my freshman dorm. Not at 4 a.m. or anything either. Nope, not this angel. But I was not. It was like particle board. But even particle board has a fresher aroma. And it took two hands to break off a piece. I choked down my first bite and then chugged some water, convinced bits were stuck in my throat. And don't you hate that? So I understand that if I had toasted it, my experience might have been better. And maybe the brown sugar cinnamon variety isn't exactly the most vibrant. Also, it is entirely possible that a dusty dormitory basement doesn't have, say, the packaged pastry turnover that a large grocery store chain does. But even at its most ideal, it could never be anything but a compromise for me. A dry, flavorless, glycerin, high fructose corn syrup, artificial strawberry flavored version of what could be homemade and flawless. I can't believe that I waited so long to make these. Neither can my still not over the Goonies thing husband, who responded to my, "What should I make next? I've got a muffin, salad, cake, and Pop-Tarts on my list," query this weekend with a, "You know how to make Pop-Tarts and you haven't yet?" Don't you love hearing things from his perspective? He's had similar reactions to fried chicken and peanut butter crispy bars. So, most recipes that I have come across use a pie dough for the pastry, but I was really stuck on getting a crust that was a little more sturdy, one with an egg. Often I see fillings of just jam, yet a little thickener added to the jam goes a long way towards keeping it from being too wet and soggy inside. Finally, a lot of versions I came across while I was digging around offer some sort of apology that the glaze, should you make one, isn't as hard as the packaged ones, that a homemade version really won't hold up well in an upright toaster, or that the brown sugar filling doesn't have the odd stiffness of the ones that you can buy at the bodega. This version does not. Sure, it may lack the sturdiness and shell-like slick of a packaged Pop-Tart, but it has the buttery, flaky, no toaster required to soften it transcendence that the grocery store aisle version can only dream about. And hooray for that. Here's the recipe, homemade Pop-Tarts. This is adapted from King Arthur flour. For the pastry, you'll need 2 cups of all-purpose flour, 1 tablespoon of sugar, 1 teaspoon of salt, 1 cup, which is 2 sticks or 8 ounces of unsalted butter cut into pats, 1 large egg, 2 tablespoons of milk, that's 1 ounce, 1 additional large egg to brush on the pastry. For the cinnamon filling, this will be enough for 9 tarts. You need 1/2 cup of brown sugar, 1 to 1.5 teaspoons of ground cinnamon to taste, 4 teaspoons of all-purpose flour, one large egg to brush on the pastry before filling. For the jam filling, you'll need 3/4 cups of jam and 1 tablespoon of cornstarch mixed with 1 tablespoon of cold water. Alternate fillings: 9 tablespoons of chocolate chips, 9 tablespoons of Nutella or other chocolate hazelnut paste, or 9 tablespoons of a delight of your choice, such as salted caramel or a nut paste. To make a cinnamon filling, you're going to whisk together the sugar, cinnamon, and flour. To make a jam filling, mix the jam with the cornstarch, water, and a small saucepan. Bring the mixture to a boil and simmer, stirring for 2 minutes. Remove from the heat and set aside to cool. This is used to fill the pastry tarts. To make the dough, you're going to whisk together the flour, sugar, and salt. Work in the butter with your fingers, pastry blender, or food processor until pea-sized lumps of butter are still visible and the mixture holds together when you squeeze it. If you've used a food processor, transfer the mixture to a large bowl. Whisk the first egg and milk together and stir them into the dough, mixing just until everything is cohesive, kneading briefly on a well-floured counter if necessary. Divide the dough in half, it's approximately 8 1/4 ounces each, and then shape each half into a smooth rectangle about 3 by 5 inches. You can roll this out immediately or wrap each half in plastic and refrigerate for up to 2 days. Next, you're going to assemble the tarts. If the dough has been chilled, remove it from the refrigerator and allow it to soften and become workable, about 15 to 20 minutes. Place one piece on a lightly floured work surface and roll it into a rectangle about 1/8 inch thick, large enough that you can trim it to an even 9 by 12 inches. You can use a 9 by 13 inch pan laid on top as guidance. Then you're going to repeat with a second piece of dough. Set the trimmings aside and then cut each piece of dough into thirds. You'll form 9 3 by 4 inch rectangles. Beat the additional egg and brush it over the entire surface of the first dough. This will be the inside of the tart. The egg is to help glue the lid on. Place a heaping tablespoon of filling into the center of each rectangle, keeping a bare 1/2 inch perimeter around it. And then place a second rectangle of dough atop your first, using your fingertips to press firmly around the pocket of filling, sealing the dough well on all sides, and then press the tines of a fork all around the edge of the rectangle and repeat with the remaining tarts. Gently place the tarts on a lightly greased or parchment-lined baking sheet and prick the top of each tart multiple times with a fork. You want to make sure that steam can escape, or the tarts will become billowy pillows rather than flat toaster pastries. Refrigerate the tarts, they don't need to be covered, for 30 minutes while you preheat your oven to 350 degrees Fahrenheit. Charming tip from King Arthur, you're going to sprinkle the dough trimmings with cinnamon sugar. These have nothing to do with your toaster pastries, but it's a shame to discard them and they make a wonderful snack. So while the tarts are chilling, bake these trimmings for 13 to 15 minutes until they're golden brown. Next, you're going to bake the tarts. Remove the tarts from the fridge and bake them for 20 to 25 minutes until they are a light golden brown, and then cool in the pan on the rack. For the whole wheat variation, I was itching to swap out 1/2 cup of the flour with whole wheat flour. I'm sure it would make it more deliciously breakfast. Pop-Tart Minis. The biggest struggle I had with these was the size. I actually like my baked goods on the tiny size. Thus, I think you could make an adorable batch of 16 2 1/4 inch by 3 inch rectangles. As far as savory Pop-Tarts, you can nix the sugar in the dough and half the salt. Fill with pesto, cheese, ground nuts, or olives, or any combination thereof. Brush the tops with additional egg wash and sprinkle with poppy or sesame seeds. And please invite me over. As far as doing ahead, the sweet versions should keep at room temperature in an airtight container for a week. If you'd like to make them further in advance, I vote for freezing them unbaked between layers of wax paper and baking them as needed. Thank you for joining us for Food and Stuff, read by Gretchen Miller.